Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, May 24, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear an update on the In Re Fosamax products liability litigation. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us J.P. Lefkowitz and Doug C. Smith, who are both partners at Kirkland & Ellis. J. Lefkowitz has argued two cases on preemption, the Mensing and Bartlett cases, in front of the Supreme Court, both for the defendant. I will turn it over to Jay to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Jay. The floor is yours.
Thanks very much. So we're going to talk a little bit this morning about the recent Third Circuit case involving Fosamax, which is an osteoporosis drug. And by way of background, I think most of us who follow the area of preemption are familiar with the underlying test for preemption in cases involving brand drugs, which is a different landscape than generic drugs. And under the Wyeth versus Levine case, a Supreme Court decision from several years ago, a state law failure to warn claim is preempted if there is clear evidence that the FDA would not have approved the desired warning. The real question, and where the rubber meets the road, is what is clear evidence? The Third Circuit's decision in Fosamax is now the most extensive appellate treatment of this test, and it took on such questions as who decides clear evidence exists and what it takes to find such clear evidence. In this situation, regrettably, the Third Circuit sided with the plaintiffs on both of those important questions. The background here is that plaintiffs brought a failure to warn claim based on the lack of a warning about an atypical femoral fracture. These are severe, non-traumatic, low-injury, complete fractures of the femur. And there was some evidence in the case about a link between Fosamax and atypical femoral fractures. So in 2008, Merck, the drug company that had developed the Fosamax product, submitted what's called a PAS, a prior approval supplement on such fractures, which included some reasonably soft language on the risk and added atypical femoral fractures to both the adverse reactions and the precaution sections. A year later, in 2009, the FDA official agreed that Merck could add to the adverse reactions, but suggested that Merck's addition to the precaution section was prolonging review and that the FDA wanted to look at this area of drugs as a class. More information then came to light about the link between biophosphonates and atypical femoral fractures in 2010. And later that year, the FDA demanded that Merck and other manufacturers add new warnings. What happened in this case is that individuals who took Fosamax before those new warnings in 2010 and suffered these fractures brought lawsuits. And the district court held that the claims were preempted under Wyeth. What the Third Circuit did was take a hard look at the district court's opinion, which looked very much like the In Re Acretin case and some of the other defendant-friendly post-Wyeth opinions, and the Third Circuit reversed. The Third Circuit recognized that prior cases, including the Acretin case, had decided that what was clear evidence was they made the decision by exhaustively surveying post-Wyeth case law and testing the facts of a particular case against the precedents. And the Third Circuit agreed that this might produce the right result in some cases, but those cases basically failed to clarify the doctrine. And so the Third Circuit announced two very sweeping and important plaintiff-friendly rules. First, clear evidence is a standard of proof synonymous with clear and convincing evidence, that the defendant has to show that it was, quote, highly probable that the FDA would not have approved a change to the drug's label. And second, whether the defendant met its burden is a question for the jury. Those are very plaintiff-friendly rules because it makes it very, very hard under that approach to make a judgment on the motion stage unless you can really articulate what the clear and convincing evidence is. And we have that certainly in some cases, but in a lot of the soft cases, the in-between cases, I think it's going to be a much harder burden right now. So the rule in the Third Circuit is that at summary judgment, a defendant would need to prove that every reasonable juror would agree that it's highly probable that the FDA would not have approved the demanded change to the drug's label. And based on the rule, the Third Circuit rejected preemption, notwithstanding the 2009 FDA letter rejecting Merck's warning. So that's really where we are in the Third Circuit. And as I said, we're litigating other cases, even in the Third Circuit, where we think the clear evidence is so strong that notwithstanding the rules laid out in Fosamax, it's perfectly appropriate for a court to grant a preemption dismissal. But I think on a lot of the closer call questions, this decision is going to make it harder.
Jay, this is Doug. How do you think that the Fosamax decision, you know, given your description of it, fits in with the case law in other circuits? And what do you think the path is going forward in this area?
I don't think we yet have a true clear split. I think we have some strong decisions that are more defendant-friendly from some of the jurisdictions. We now have this Third Circuit decision that says there's a much higher standard to meet. It's not clear at all from reading the text of Wyeth itself that when the court talked about clear evidence, they were in any way articulating a standard of proof that would be synonymous with clear and convincing evidence. After all, we're talking about, you know, what a regulator would do. It's in the subjunctive. The way the phrase is articulated in Wyeth, it's a subjunctive question. What would the FDA do? So by definition, you're in those situations, you may not have actual proof of a letter decision by the FDA rejecting a particular label change. Obviously, when you have that kind of evidence, even under the Fosamax standard, you know, I think you'll have a pretty good case for preemption. But it's not clear that the Third Circuit here is right. But certainly the Third Circuit's treatment of Merck's notes from its calls, for example, suggests that call notes that companies have with the FDA, at least in the Third Circuit, you know, may not be that relevant because they're always going to require credibility and veracity determinations. And, you know, most PAF rejections may not have that much relevance in the Third Circuit because there often are going to be factual questions about the precise reason why the FDA rejected a PAS. Now, again, there are going to be some PAS rejections where it's clear why the FDA rejected it. If they specifically say, look, we're not convinced that there is any statistically greater risk here than in another situation, so therefore we're rejecting your risk, your modification, that might still be strong enough. But, you know, it's going to require a lot more effort, I think, from here on out, at least with respect to courts that follow the Fosamax rule.
And, Jay, this is Doug again. One other issue that the defendants had raised was they attempted to argue that the preemption issue was always an issue that should be resolved as a matter of law by the court rather than allowing it to go to the jury to resolve factual issues. Do you have any view on that, or what's your take?
You know, I think it, as a general rule, preemption is an issue that can be resolved as a matter of law, but you know, depending on how you read what the Supreme Court has articulated as a standard in terms of clear evidence, there clearly is an argument that the determination of what is clear evidence requires some fact-finding. So I think it's, at this point, clearly an open question.
Doug, do you have any more questions, or should we go to audience questions?
Maybe we should go to the audience questions now.
All right. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, May 18th, at the unusual time of 10 a.m. That call will feature two members of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, Ambassador Boyden Gray, founding partner at Boyden Gray & Associates, and chairman of Agency Enforcement and Coercion Working Group at the Federalist Society, and Devin Westhill, who is the director of the Regulatory Transparency Project. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls, and you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleform conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any audience questions. Doug, do you have any more for Jay?
Yeah, sure. Jay, you mentioned the clear evidence standard articulated in Wyeth. There's not really much of a discussion in Wyeth, which is why we have this debate in the, you know, in the lower courts. Do you think that the Supreme Court was really intending to articulate some heightened standard, or do you think that plaintiffs in these cases are making more than they should out of this, you know, the statement in a single sentence in Wyeth about clear evidence?
No, I actually think that the court probably was not trying to impose any special burden here, as the Third Circuit has, construed it. In fact, if you go back to the Geyer case back in 2000, that case held, and that was an important implied preemption case, that the imposition of any, quote, special burden on an implied preemption defense lacks basis in this court's precedents, and the court said it creates the practical difficulty by further complicating well-established preemption principles. And so I don't think that the court really intended to subject the preemption defense to this type of heightened standard. So I do think that in time we will get an opportunity to revisit the Third Circuit decision. And as I said, I think that there are still a significant number of cases raising preemption in the context of the Wyeth clear evidence standard, even in the Third Circuit, where notwithstanding the groundwork laid out in Fosamax, where trial courts could easily find preemption based on the facts in those cases and the pleadings in those cases.
Jay, you mentioned the clear evidence standard and the court's prior precedents. What effect, if any, do you think, you know, now that we have a different composition on the court with Justice Gorsuch, what do you think that's going to mean for preemption, if anything?
Look, I'm always skeptical of anticipating what particular justices are going to do on any given day and on any given case, although based on some of the decisions from his circuit court experience, I think Justice Gorsuch will be receptive to preemption arguments. He has actually written some good preemption decisions. He's addressed Buckman in a very solid way. So I think he will be friendly to preemption arguments, just as a structural matter.
And Jay, with respect to the Fosamax decision itself, do you know if there's, I mean, obviously the time I don't think is run for a cert petition. Do you anticipate that that case itself might be a case that would be taken up?
You know, again, it's not clear to me that there is a sufficient enough circuit split yet to make this a high likelihood by any means of a grant. Although it's a very important issue, I think it does cry out for certainly correction and clarification of the standard. We've now had several years of experience with the YS clear evidence standard. I thought there was a very good vehicle, actually, that I tried to tee up in a cert petition last year in a case for Johnson & Johnson coming out of the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, which the court didn't take. I think it's just a matter of time before they take one of these cases and use it as a vehicle for really setting some bright lines here in terms of what clear evidence means. So I certainly hope this will be one of those cases.
And Jay, you mentioned some of the other decisions like the Incretin decision. Do you think have been any trends since Wyeth? And does this Fosamax decision, do you think that it changes anything in terms of the overall trend in this area?
Look, anytime you have a circuit court of appeals writing a very extensive opinion, whether you like the result of the opinion or not, they clearly devoted a lot of ink to this. They laid out a clear set of standards and guidelines. And I think for judges around the country who are dubious about preemption generally, basically believe that state tort litigation should never be impeded, I think this will be this will provide a lot of ammunition for such judges.
And why do you think that there is some skepticism about preemption among the judiciary?
I think, well, I don't know about across the judiciary, but I certainly think that particularly in the drug industry, there is a prevailing view among a lot of people out there that the FDA just needs help and the private tort bar should be in power to provide that help. I think it in many respects, it flies in the face of good science, of good health practices, and of, you know, the supremacy clause, but that hasn't stopped judges from, you know, from having a bit of a bias against preemption. I think there is still occasionally talk in lower courts about a presumption against preemption, even though we haven't seen very much of a presumption against preemption even articulated in a lot of the recent Supreme Court decisions. And there's certainly no real basis, I think, in constitutional law to assume that there should be a presumption against preemption when, in fact, the presumption should be, you know, arguably in favor of the supremacy clause.
I think we have our first audience question, so let's go to that caller.
Hi, it's David Tryon in Cleveland, and I do some products liability matters. This is not a specific area that I follow a lot, but I'm noticing that there is another case in the Sixth Circuit where I'm at, Ryan Frank versus Abbott Labs, which is a 2017 case. And I'm interested if you're familiar with that and how that, you know, compares to the case in the Third Circuit.
Doug, are you familiar? I'm not involved in that case.
I'm not sure. There is a Depakote case I know that I think was decided in the Sixth Circuit, and if I remember correctly, they did hold that preemption applied and at least barred part of the claims. And my recollection is that was actually a very good decision, that if it's the same one, I just can't recall the name of the case, but my recollection is that was a very good decision, that was a recent decision on preemption that arguably is consistent with the trend recently, where I think, you know, Jay had mentioned the Incretin case that's now up, you know, on appeal in the Ninth Circuit, where courts have been receptive, where there is a record that the FDA would not have accepted labeling changes and have held that claims are preempted under those circumstances, and certainly haven't adopted the, you know, arguably unsupported and very high, you know, a higher burden that the FOSSA Max Court did. I mean, Jay, that raises one other question. Are you aware of any other court other than FOSSA Max that has tried to read into this clear evidence standard some kind of heightened burden for the defendants?
No, I think they are the first one to really tee that up.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any more audience questions. Doug, do you have any more questions?
Yeah, let me just ask this. You know, coming from it as more of a, from the trial perspective, what do you think the significance of these preemption arguments really is in the overall, you know, litigation? I guess on the one hand, you could say defendants have certainly benefited from these arguments because they can be decided, you know, on a limited record before full-blown discovery gets underway. And in the Incredin case, they're all actually the court phased discovery to, you know, limit the amount of discovery that it would allow the plaintiffs to take, just to issues like preemption and general causation. On the other hand, one might argue, well, if the preemption arguments go out the window, a lot of this could be swept up in the causation issue to say, you know, of course the FDA would not require a warning because the evidence just isn't there on causation, and so you have essentially a second bite at the apple when you get to the causation issue. You can argue that the scientific evidence just isn't there, and that's why no warning has been implemented. Jay, do you have any view on, you know, how significant are these issues and how important are they to defendants in this kind of litigation?
Oh, I think it's very important to defendants to be able to get out of cases at a motion to dismiss or at a summary judgment stage on preemption. You know, I think the and the caller who just called in about the Rheinfrank case, you know, it was obviously a favorable decision on preemption. And I think there have been, you know, a fair number of good decisions, which is why I think, you know, people kind of took note of the FOSSA Max decision when it came down, because it articulated a standard that will just make it harder and force potentially a lot more cases to go to trial. And of course, you know, once you're going to trial, the costs involved are just, you know, exponentially grow. So I think it is really important to have a viable preemption defense. And I think, you know, again, where I think the kind of typical juries never think in the context of overwarning, whereas the FDA certainly has expressed its concern about overwarning. And, you know, if warnings are just a one-way ratchet, and you look at it that way, it's always a little bit hard to suggest that, well, some additional warning wouldn't be at least better preventative in some context. If you look at it from not a sitting as a juror in a particular one-off case where someone's already suffered an injury, but you're looking at it from a public health perspective, the way the FDA does, then you've got to be concerned with overwarning as well. And that's where I think the clear evidence rule is so important and should have some real vitality in terms of preemption.
And Jay, just one other question. If I recall correctly, at one time the FDA had issued some regulations on preemption. Do you anticipate that with the new administration that the FDA is going to weigh in on this issue or try to say anything or do anything that might be either useful or not to defendants with respect to this preemption issue?
Well, one thing I would hope that the administration does very, very promptly is reverse the or just withdraw the Obama executive order that basically directed agencies to look askance at preemption in pretty much all contexts. To me, there's absolutely no reason to put a thumb on the scale in that respect. The second thing I would hope that this administration does is do what the Bush administration did, which is direct the agencies to file amicus briefs in appropriate situations and appropriate cases on behalf of preemption. After all, preemption is, in a sense, a defense of the agency's prerogatives to have real exclusive control and authority over drug labeling, and that's clearly in the interest of public health by and large. And so I think that's another area where this administration, if it decides to be a little more active in the regulatory space, could play an important role. I certainly think that the new administration also means that the efforts that the FDA had been undertaking over the last several years to potentially revisit preemption more generally in a more hostile to defendants way will not come to pass, and certainly the efforts to eliminate generic preemption won't happen either.
Okay, well, I think that's all my questions. Laura?
I'll make a final call for audience questions. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. But not saying any, would either of you like to make some closing remarks?
Jay, do you have some
I think from my perspective, it's been a good discussion.
Great. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.